Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to A Few Things with Claire and Erica. I'm Claire.
I'm Erica.
And this is our podcast about all the things we love.
It is based off our newsletter, 10 Things That We Send Every Monday. That is 10 Things That We Love.
We send it every Monday, whether we like it or not.
That's right. And this one we didn't get, we call it A Few Things so that we didn't hem ourselves into that 10.
That's right. But we still do it every Wednesday, whether we like it or not.
Correct. That's also very true. It is, both of those things are an offshoot of our website, ofakind.com, where we sell the pieces and tell the stories of very talented emerging designers in the fashion and home and sometimes even baby space.
Baby, sometimes beauty.
Sometimes, yeah.
I don't know if you call them beauty designers, but you know.
Yeah. Makers.
Basically, we sell a lot of great stuff.
Check it out.
Today, we are going to answer a question from a reader.
Burning question.
No, listener. She might be reading.
She's
too.
Both.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Burning question. What tights should she buy?
How about tights?
She didn't ask about socks, but we're going to answer that question
yeah,
too.
That's something we're interested in also.
So you get this also.
This is the hosiery segment. Yeah. Of the
yeah, that's what they called at department stores.
Yeah.
Coming from someone whose first job was at a department store, I am not surprised that you knew that.
This is the hosiery department of a few things.
So I think we should start with your recommendation because you have really strong feelings about tights.
I have super strong feelings about tights. I am obsessed with Wolford. There is a reason why it is such like a classic cult. Brand.
Yeah.
It is expensive. It is totally worth it. Mm-hmm. Don't buy Wolford tights if you want to buy new tights in January because yours are all worn out and disgusting. Don't buy Wolford ones.
No, only buy them if you want them to last all year.
That's right. And maybe even 2 years.
Yeah.
Which is, they've never run on me.
It's amazing.
Even when they catch, they get like a little snag, but it won't ruin them.
That's amazing.
They're super like thick and they feel good and luxurious and never like itchy, scratchy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. Do they get linty?
No.
That's awesome.
No. And even if, and they like eventually, if you wear them with ankle boots or something a lot, they get pilly. And
yep.
But you can still wear them or you can use like a depiller on them and they won't tear. That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
So the ones I like are the Velvet Deluxe 66 or the Matte Opaque 80. The Matte Opaque 80 are a little bit heavier and more opaque. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom has always worn Wolford tights for some reason, despite the fact that I'm totally irresponsible with money. I've always been like, I can't do that. That's not, they're too expensive for me. But I think this is going to be the year that if it ever gets cold enough to wear tights in New York, I will purchase a pair of Wolford tights.
Once I bought them, I never went back.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's one of those things where you're like, I'm a grown up person.
Totally.
I should be paying money for tights that are something I'm going to wear most days of the year or when it's cold outside.
Do you only ever wear black tights?
Yeah.
Did you ever go through a phase of doing that? Like, God, I wore like purple tights once. It's really embarrassing now that I look back and I'll probably do it again. But
well, you do think you'll do it again? When you're like 60?
No, just like when it somehow comes back, like, and I'm air quoting, but nobody can see it in fashion. Like, I
could see like an oxblood or a dark gray, maybe, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't want to think about it too much because I was like 2010.
And also, I think maybe it just calls too much attention in a way that I don't like.
Calls a lot of attention. It just, I don't know. Let's move on. I don't want to think too much about that period of my life. Here's my deal with tights.
Yeah.
I don't ever, never really spent a lot of money on thought about it, but I do think that Hue and DKNY for like mall brand tights are really opaque and last a decently long time.
Yep.
I totally accidentally discovered Spanx tights because I was leaving for a business trip and I was at a drugstore that happened to have Spanx tights.
And at a drugstore? That feels
really
impressive
random, right?
To
well,
me.
Like New York drugstores are
bougie. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
So I bought these tights and they're reversible, which was amazing. They're black on one side and charcoal gray on the other. And I will wear a charcoal gray tight every once in a while, rarely. They're really opaque. They last a really long time. And they're like control top-ish, but not crazily, but they're just so thick and opaque, but not dramatically so. And they've lasted me a really long time. They feel like a good investment. So I endorse those if you see those at the drugstore.
Can we talk about tight care and wearing and tactics and all of that? So you sometimes wear two pairs of tights, which is
often.
So okay. This is insane to me. It's like both genius and insane.
During the winter, if you wear two pairs of tights, I feel like that's as warm as anything you're ever going to get.
Yeah.
It is. The problem with it is that if you have a really salty dinner or too much to drink and you get a little bit bloated, it starts to really hurt your toes at the end
because of the day. You've lost circulation.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. Yes, because you've lost circulation. Yeah. But in general, during the winter, I'm almost, when it's really cold out, almost always wearing at least one or two pairs of tights, because if I'm not wearing two pairs of tights and a skirt, I'm wearing jeans with tights underneath them. Because I think
that's something my mom used to do for sure.
Well, because I just think the tights are like the warmest thing. It's like, I don't know, it's like polyester, it's nylon, and it's
a synthetic that's trapping heat.
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's so warm. And so it hasn't gotten cold enough this winter to do it, but I think that tights, doubling up tights is so warm. And people, I always hate that point in the winter where you're like, I've worn jeans every single day this month and you want to wear a skirt, but it feels too cold. And
yeah,
I just think two tights is the answer.
How often do you wash your tights?
I'm not going to answer that.
Yeah. I feel like it's like, how often do you wash your bra? Like, not as much as I should.
Don't want to discuss it.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. Okay.
Not your business.
Something that we,
how often do you wash your tights, Rulo?
I think that because the Wolford ones are so opaque, they mm-hmm. and it, this is like maybe worse than not washing them. Mm-hmm. They get like skin.
Oh yeah, that happens. Yeah,
on like the toes. That's gross.
It's probably because you're not using enough coconut oil.
Well, on my bottom of my feet.
Okay.
Whatever. So I feel like I wash them for that purpose more than anything.
Okay.
Because they look like they need washing.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Know. And then what do you do? You just soak them, or what do you do?
No, I throw them straight into the wash machine.
You don't put them in a net?
No, because Wolford tights can take it.
Wow. And then you throw them in the dryer too?
Yeah. Tumble dry low. They're fine.
With anything else? Like, what about zippers on your things?
Not worried about it.
Huh. Okay. I mean, if I thought I could do that, I'd be washing them a lot, I think.
Yeah.
I just don't think I can do that.
I think the Wolford ones can take it.
That's ballsy.
Yeah.
You should get one of those little nets my mom has.
I have them. I don't like them. I don't know why.
The kind with the zipper?
Yeah. I don't know why. Yeah.
All right.
It feels like a whole other process.
Yeah, that's true. Do you do the laundry in your family?
We both do the laundry.
Okay.
Yeah. My husband and I. Yeah.
Okay. You sidetrack.
Okay. Okay.
No, I don't. I don't do the laundry, so I can't be making requests about fishing things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Socks, quickly. Mm-hmm. I know a couple years ago for the holidays, mm-hmm. Your husband bought you socks ton of socks.
No, well, what happened was that my husband emailed Erica and was like, what does Claire really need? Right.
But he was basically like, her sock drawer is out of control and I don't understand what's happening there. And I feel like maybe if I buy her some nice matching ones, we can like help this problem. And I was like, sure. I don't know.
The next time we bring Tidy Tova on, we also have to ask her about my sock drawer because she used to clean my home and she was scandalized by it.
I'm sure.
Yeah, so I'm bad about keeping socks in pairs in general, and my sock drawer still explodes despite my constant efforts to KonMari it. So the socks that I actually like, if the really luxe, like the Wolford of my sock drawer is Falke, F-A-L-K-E.
Ooh,
they're really nice and beautiful patterns. I don't know. I just like, I discovered them once at Neiman Marcus, and then they're just really nice and thin but warm. But the ones I really like now are reasonably priced are Richer Poorer.
Yes. The Richer Poorer ones are good for men and women.
Exactly. They're really nice, cute patterns. And then for running, I like Features. I swear by the Features. F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. But since this summer when I started running in Nike Flyknits, I stopped wearing socks when I run for the most part, which I really like a lot. There's a lot to like about running sockless. The problem is it does make your shoes really stinky.
Does it help your toes like splay better, or like what do you like about it?
It's a great question. I like not like having to find a pair of matching socks before I go running.
It's like maybe as much in the prep as everything else.
Yeah. It's also just like, I don't know. I really like the way Nike Flyknits feel because they kind of suction your feet in and it feels like a sock already. Because the Nike Flyknit, the idea is the entire shoe is woven from one piece. It's not like sewn anywhere.
Yeah.
And so it just feels nice. And I don't know, your feet feel freer somehow, I guess. But when I am wearing socks, I really like the Features quite a bit. But I'm in search of a good shoe deodorizer. Liz, who works with us, told me she found this one called Audubon. So I'll give it a shot. I don't know.
It sounds serious.
It sounds serious. I mean, right now I just use baby powder, which more or less works.
Yeah. The sock brand, it's not boring like that, but it's just like, they're not interesting colors and patterns for sure, is Smart Wool.
Yeah. It's a great product.
Wool socks, your feet don't get sweaty in them, which you would never, I don't know. Wool's kind of magical like that if you give it a chance. The ones I like are called Hide and Seek, and they're like little booty socks, but they stay on. They don't slip off.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about talking about booties, like the little, like, the socks,
like petty socks. Yeah, but
so your Peds are Smart Wool.
Yeah, but they're not. They're like a little bit bigger than Peds. They're good for. They wouldn't be good for a ballet flat, but they're good for anything else.
Oh well, yeah, that's not what I like. Like I'm wearing right now because I'm wearing an Oxford, but I'm wearing a sock underneath. But you can't see the sock.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what I like. Yeah. Really into those. I just get like a nameless brand on Amazon.
Smart Wool Hide and Seek.
Okay, really I've also good. Been told Sperry are really make a really good brand of those because they have like those
so many
shoes.
Boat shoes that require this.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Okay, I'm going to look into that. Thank you for the tip.
You're welcome. Hey, on that note, should we take a break Let's and come back with something even more interesting than hosiery?
than socks? Yeah. Okay, BRB.
You want when you get up in the morning, cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet, just a plan our hand till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been. Oh, won't they come along and spread some honey too?
You've been listening to A Few Things with Claire and Erica, and we got caught up during their commercial break talking to our guests, the amazing designers behind Lizzie Fortunato, Lizzie and Catherine.
Who had thoughts about socks and introduced the idea of fashion socks, which I don't think we even really covered.
Tell us
like,
about
left
socks.
Left out an entire
Before
category.
You tell us about anything that you came here to talk about socks for us for a minute.
Well, this is Catherine. When I wear very few winter socks. I actually only have one brand of winter socks that I wear, and I only have four pairs, so they're
what
in
are they?
Rotation. They are from this store called Tabio in Paris,
okay.
So
Ooh.
Unfortunately they're not local. But the good Fancy. News is if you're going to Paris and you want a souvenir and you don't want to spend, like, 300 euros, you can just go to the sock store and get yourself some sparkly socks and like come home and wear them every day.
But they're winter sparkly socks?
I mean, they're thin, but like, you know, we're in New York. You're not outside that much. So like they totally, they're definitely not for hiking. They're for indoor New York City girls who need a little party on their ankle. So when we go to Paris, I make a stop at Tabio and they have the most amazing sparkly socks. They're actually, I think, a Japanese brand, but Tabio sells them.
That's what I was going to say is I forgot that when I went to Japan, one of my souvenirs was sparkly socks, which are like insane and sheer and have ruffles on them. And I kind of never wear them because they're really a statement, but they're fun.
Totally. I love like the crazy, crazy ones. Yeah. These are like less crazy, but
like minimalist sparkly.
But it's like a navy sparkle or like
That's
a dark
pretty.
Gold sparkle. And it's pretty. If you have like a black pant and a boot or like a loafer, you could even wear socks with your loafer.
I love that.
So that's what I do.
Lizzie.
I have not been, but I heard that the socks at Koss in Soho
are amazing. So that was the recent hot tip. I was with a friend of mine who's a fashion designer, and she was buying one of her coworkers for her Secret Santa socks from Cox.
That's a great Secret Santa gift.
That is really good. Something you would actually use.
Do you guys see, for the most part, my socks are never on display, but I feel like you two, Lizzie and Catherine, might display your socks a little bit more.
We're really short, so we have the we have the short pants on lockdown. So in the wintertime, when you have a loafer and a short pant, you need a sock.
See, I never wear a loafer and a in the winter.
I mean, you're smart.
Yeah, you're smart.
You probably should.
Thank goodness we can get away with it this winter.
Yes. Okay, so now you guys have to tell us what you're actually here to talk about, which is your business, your amazing business that you've been at. How long have you been working on Lizzie Fortunato?
Forever.
Well, so we didn't even say it's a jewelry line. It's
a jewelry line, a leather goods line. Yeah, guys give us the whole...
And they're twins. Tell that part.
So I'm Lizzie. I'm the creative director of Lizzie Fortunato, and then I work with Catherine, my twin sister, who directs all our operations. And we are a jewelry line, but we also do leather goods, and we recently introduced lifestyle to our website as well. So it's kind of 360 accessories at this point.
Yes. Like your amazing pillows that Claire got me for Hanukkah.
Oh my gosh, you got them already. Yay, it's no longer a surprise.
Yeah. Yes. Hanukkah's over. Of course you got them.
Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
We rounded out jewelry and leather in the past year with the textiles and ceramics and all of the fortune finds, as we call them, that we were collecting from our travels. So that kind of gives our customer a little bit of idea of the Lizzie world, which she's both putting in her house and also wearing on her neck and carrying in her clutch.
Exactly. And we're it's interesting, like, it's hard for us to define when we started, because we actually started when we were at Duke University in undergrad together. So
is that when you fully, like, formed an LLC or whatever it is?
It's not. That's where the foundation for the business was really laid. I was making jewelry, attracting a captive audience down there. Catherine was putting together trunk shows, so we knew that there was something there. We thought it was a
hobby.
Were you
branding it in any way, or you were just like, here's these...
We actually probably would not have a script logo today unless we developed the script logo at Duke.
Really?
So
yeah.
The logo is
it's
the
so
one
good
thing
and timeless.
Oh, that's so nice of you. We always look at it and we're like, we need a hip, cool logo.
But I think everybody feels that way, but I like yours.
Our cursive script logo was definitely born out of a dorm room.
But we did it.
Probably Lizzie.
I think I did on Microsoft Word.
So can you talk about... I feel like one of my very favorite origin stories is yours. And talking about you hosting trunk shows out of dorm rooms and all of that.
So we were at Duke together, and freshman year, we did not live together, but Lizzie was making jewelry really just for fun. I mean, it's a hobby. She's always been creative. She made her prom dress in high school. She's really just always been incredibly creative and been able to put things together. So she was making jewelry, and girls sort of took note of it. And, we were in Durham, North Carolina, where there's not a ton of shopping, but you've got plenty of girls going to their sorority formals. So girls would stop by our dorm room and say, you know, I have a formal tonight, or I'm going on a date. Can I borrow a necklace? Or do you have a pair of earrings? Can I buy a pair of earrings from you? And we still joke.
Where were you guys sourcing the materials?
Well, it's interesting because there is an incredible bead store in Raleigh, North Carolina, called Ornamentia, that I would visit very frequently. And so I was really working with what they had. I would find, like, seed beads there or different chains there, but I was definitely limited by what they had. With that said, it was an awesome store, so I had a pretty good resource there.
And this was like, were you taking classes in jewelry making, or this was
side hustle?
Okay.
Yeah. Totally self-taught. Okay. So girls would ask for pieces, and Lizzie would say, like, sure, you can have it. And being the more entrepreneurial, I guess, at the time of the two of us, I was like, and no, you can sell it to them, Lizzie.
You can buy it.
I was working at a restaurant at the time.
Catherine being like, no.
Exactly. I was working at a restaurant at the time, and sophomore year, we convinced the restaurant, I think on like one of their days that they were closed, to give us their back room so we could have a little trunk show. And I remember, don't you remember those hot pink flyers we posted around campus
for
the Lizzie Fortunato trunk show? I mean, honestly, the branding was not top notch. So we posted flyers and we did this trunk show, and I remember girls were lined up before we even were prepared to open the doors.
That's amazing, you guys. I'm getting chills. That's so cool.
And I remember we sold out in about half an hour and took orders then for people who wanted to order pieces that they hadn't.
Did you have anybody else working it with you, or it was just the two of you?
It was just
I think it was just the two of us. I'm sure we had friends pitching in and helping out. I mean, it feels so long ago. It's incredible. But But we were sold
out. Well, how long ago? So this was like 2004?
That was 2004.
Yeah, around 2004. And and we would take orders.
12 years ago.
Yeah, yeah, which is wild. We would take orders at the trunk shows. And it got to the point where we started signing up for the same classes so that Catherine could go to class for us. And I was sitting in our apartment watching daytime television, stringing beads.
It wasn't even an apartment at the time. It was a dorm room. Don't you remember?
When you tell that story, do your parents get so annoyed? Like, why were we paying for your college? Yes.
My dad wants a refund.
Why did I just put one of you to college?
My dad definitely wants a refund. Lizzie, in all fairness, graduated with an insane GPA as an English and art history major. So she's selling herself short, but I think the requisites like Spanish and biology, she definitely missed out on.
Yeah.
Which honestly wouldn't probably serve her very well in her jewelry business anyway. So we launched the business, but we kept saying all along that, you know, we're going to get real jobs after college. We always thought of it as just a hobby, a way to subsidize spring breaks. We really thought of it that it was just a fleeting sort of 2 or 3 years.
Did you have a business bank account? Like, when you were making money, what were you doing with the money?
Don't you remember we went to that Italian restaurant and counted all our money? I don't know if we had a business bank. I do not know what we did with that money. I mean, it was like $3,000.
That's maybe still something. Are you just like splitting it down the middle?
What did we do with it?
You bought like plane tickets to Cabo.
We paid
like,
that's it. We went to Paris for spring break.
Yeah. Little did we know that we'd have to go there for work for like the next decade. Should have gone somewhere else.
That's a very good question. Maybe we did have a business one. Knowing me and my supposed business acumen and how sort of uptight I am, we probably had a business bank account. I was like, probably paying taxes then unnecessarily or something. But we both then applied for quote unquote real jobs for after graduation. So Lizzie went into fashion PR and I went into finance. Lizzie, do you want to talk about your fashion PR days?
My fashion PR days were short lived. I was at Paul Wilmot Communications, which is a really high end fashion PR firm here in New York. And let's just say I was not cut out to be a publicist. I lasted about 10 months, but was so fortunate because I had other Duke friends and just friends I had met over the years of interning in New York summers between college and whatnot, who were kind of in entry-level positions at a bunch of magazines. So they would reach out to me and say, are you making jewelry? You know, my editor's working on a blue story. If you have a blue necklace, drop it off at the Messenger Center. I'll see if I can work it in. So I was literally like, could be found like stalking around the Condé Nast and Hearst Messenger Centers at about 7 in the morning before I went to my PR job. And it got to the point where things were starting to be featured and I was staying up till like 2-3 in the morning making jewelry.
Did you have a website at this point where people could buy it?
No.
It was purely editorial.
But our first website, our brother built.
Our brother bought our first website, which maybe wasn't for like a year or two after this.
So people were putting it and they were giving credits, but there was nowhere people could buy it.
Yeah, like, and the credits were few and far between, but there was definitely like a word of mouth thing happening.
There was some interest.
There was some interest and like there was enough buzz that after 10 months, excuse me, at Paul Wilmot, I was like, you know, let's go for this and see what happens.
Yeah.
So we launched Lizzie officially launched the business from our sofa on the Lower East Side in a tiny little apartment that was our first apartment after school. And so that in 2007, she sort of quit and started making a collection. And then we officially launched the business in 2008. So I guess that puts us at about the 7-year mark, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
And
so how did you go about getting your first accounts?
It was really pounding the pavement. I mean, I was walking around the West Village with like a purse full of samples of necklaces that I had made. And I would go into stores and hope that someone would take notice about something I was wearing or we could strike up a conversation. And this was hard for me because as the creative person, I really depended on Catherine for most of the sales. But she was in this 24/7 finance job and totally unavailable. So whilst she was kind of helping me on nights and weekends, in terms of pitching to stores, I was really responsible for that in the beginning. And it was so difficult to get up the nerve to go in somewhere and try and sell your own product.
So you would go in and like just start talking to
I would start
girl?
Talking to someone. I would say, I make jewelry. Are you interested in it? And oftentimes the shop girl has no relation even to the buyer.
Yeah. Right.
So I would leave my information. Sometimes she would take a few cell phone pictures. And slowly but surely, like a few stores started taking interest. And
Were you being really selective about the stores you were going to?
Yeah, we were definitely trying to be. Our first account was Albertine on Christopher Street in the West Village. The owner, Kyung Lee, had like such a fabulous reputation of really discovering young designers. So when she picked up a few pieces, it was this huge thrill. And after that, it was easier to work with other stores because suddenly you were...
You had this it's like on your the business right. resume.
You yeah. totally were credentialized.
So much of business Keon. Works that way, where yeah. it's like oh you get gosh. Your first yes, and then all of the other ones. Like we were really yes. lucky to have Mandy Kuhn and you guys actually, and Matt Singer be like the first three people who said yes, and then
people
everybody
who
else
were super
like,
well was respected.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
other exactly. brands really wanted to be alongside.
It's also just, I mean, I know it sounds cliche, but the networking and the being out there and the pounding the pavement is how we built the business. And we would have these long spells where we were in the office late at night. And
by the office, she means our apartment.
Right. right. And then even like we finally moved into our first office in 2010. Yeah. But even in that first office, like I can just remember really just burning the midnight oil there. And you wouldn't feel the rewards of it. And you mm-hmm. would feel like, oh my gosh, I've got my head down and no one really knows what I'm doing. Although I swear I'm working hard.
Yeah.
And then you would sort of take this break, or maybe you would work, but it would be much more in terms of networking and being out and yeah. about. And the rewards were sort of would multiply because people actually could meet you and could see your jewelry and yeah. you weren't sort of hidden behind a desk somewhere.
Well, the four of us like will like try to pep talk each other into going out more and be like, you guys, we're just going to do it. We're going to go have one drink
and just like get Fortunato of a kind New Year's resolution every yeah. single year.
Every January, best yeah. time of year to try to get yourself to go out.
Yeah. yeah. Like guys, we just have to go out more and like be more like cool girl. Like we're yeah. going to get our picture taken. It's going to be fine.
Yeah. We're just going to do that and then we're going to leave.
It's yeah. the pre-fashion week prep talk.
Exactly.
It lasts for about 2 weeks.
Catherine, at what point did you decide you were going to quit your job and join the business? And this was going to go to that scale.
Yeah, I feel like for many, many months and even years, I said, Lizzie, I'm going to join you. I'm going to join you full time. And I'm going to get up the nerve to quit this job. And I was working at Goldman Sachs, and I actually truly loved my job. And I was on the trading floor, and it was high adrenaline. And it was in 2008, so we were really busy given the times. And I would always say...
That is such a lovely way of saying that.
Say anything negative whatsoever.
And so I would always tell Lizzie, I'm going to join. And Lizzie, while sympathetic to that, at one point finally looked me straight in the eye and said, no one's going to push pause on your 20s. No one's going to tell you that you can just repeat this after you've made all your money and can go back to being 22 again and then can do it all over again the way you wished you had done it. So you need to make a decision, and only you can march in there and make a change in your life. So, and no one's going to do it for you.
Oh my God, I got chills again.
It was
I've
incredible.
Never heard that
it really, it was really good because I just kept saying next year, next bonus. And I feel like, you yeah. know, people in corporate jobs where you get your bonus at the end of the year, they're yeah. always,
that's how everybody
I'll stay
lives.
Till the end yeah. of the year. I'll stay yeah. till the end of the year. And then it's the next year. And yeah. you know, in a job like that, it's a slippery slope where they treat you well and you're getting paid well. And I was,
and then you buy your first apartment and you get a mortgage, and then you're really trapped.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I had these fears of waking up at, you know, 35 or 45 and thinking, wow, I had this great opportunity and I never did anything with it. So one day in 2010, I told my boss, you know, I really, he knew we had the jewelry business and he knew that that was Lizzie's full-time job and my nighttime job. Mm-hmm. And I said, I absolutely love working here, but I have this opportunity and I can't not take it. And we need to hire, you know, a full-time operations manager, and I'm going to be it. And he said, I'll hire an operations manager for you. I'll find someone. I will hire you an operations manager. I'm like, wow. No, you don't get it. I want to be the operations manager. And so then fast forward a few months, and it was my first day in the office on an August hot, sweaty night without
of
air conditioning in 2010.
Okay. Wait, that was when you quit?
Yeah, so I hit the five-year mark this year, which
Yeah, because that's when we started. And yeah. when I remember when we started, it felt like you guys had been doing it forever, and you already had an office, and I thought the office was so glam, and it was actually a closet.
It was a closet. It was
a large closet. A walk-in closet.
It was a large walk-in closet. And I remember getting in a war at 1 a.m. that first night with the packing tape thinking, what have I done? But fast forward, and we have air conditioning, and things are a little bit more
and an
civilized.
Actually legit fancy office that has a little showroom component. And
it's a good office.
Yeah. It's a great office.
Yeah. How do you go from scaling what was initially a handmade business into one that, you know, can have much more reach?
I would say... I mean, we're lucky. The demand forced us to scale. We were, it's our production that really had to catch up. Yeah. So we're lucky that the demand was there. 2008 is obviously a hard time to start a business. And,
yeah.
And we're so grateful that like we were able to sustain ourselves through that. We're self-funded, and to be able to like bring in enough income to like pay your manufacturers and retain your stores during that time was an awesome thing. Our challenge in terms of scaling was really our production. And when it started, I was making everything myself. So we first had to find people who could like do the handmade techniques that I was doing. Suddenly we were employing metalsmiths and stone setters and polishers, and all of that was done locally, and it still primarily is. We're using a few vendors in Los Angeles, but 98% of the collection is made here in New York. And so we were really struggling to like go out and find people who could do the work we wanted. And anyone who's in the fashion industry in New York knows that's a lot of like knocking on doors, and it's not something
there's
that's
not
just,
like a handbook you can open. And
there's
like,
not a handbook. And the CFDA has done a terrific job of putting together lists of different vendors, and they've really put a lot of energy into like rehabilitating the garment industry and manufacturing industry. And they do have some great resources
that's,
in terms of
that's
lists.
The Council of Fashion Designers of America.
Yes,
for all you listeners out
but
there.
there's not really like a magic right. phone book of I want to start a business. Here's who I call
was
to
there
like,
any,
produce this.
Was there anybody who just out of the kindness of their heart mentored you in that way?
Yeah, definitely. I was good friends with Lisa Salzer of Lulu mm-hmm. Frost, and I'm such a fan of her work. And yep. she was a few years ahead of me and like had started this line with just booming success.
And she also went to Duke, right?
She was at Dartmouth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We had mutual friends who introduced us, and she was like so sweet from the onset of just kind of like introducing me to the industry. And I think it's interesting, the jewelry industry in New York is pretty close-knit. I have a lot of good friends who are jewelry designers, so it feels like a pretty supportive community. With that said, there still is the element of trying to go out and figure out who's going to make the stuff when you get a big order, who's going to be reliable and deliver on time. And one thing that I had to deal with, too, was designing better for our manufacturing capacity. I, in the beginning, really would force these designs that used, like, one random rock that I found mm-hmm. on the ground in Colorado, mm-hmm. and then told Catherine, oh, let's go figure out how to replicate this.
Right.
And so it got to the point where I was like, okay, let's use materials that still seem cool and unexpected, but that we can actually replicate, because you have to learn how to design
into
your capacity.
And that's like you also being a business person, too, in addition to being the designer.
Yeah.
So you started to do this stuff and find, you know, all of your vendors in New York. What are your relationships like with them?
They're really intimate. I mean, our team has grown enough that it's not necessarily me talking to them every day at this point. But we have a production manager who's so on the ball and visits them like a few times a week and is communicating with them. And a lot of these people are like, you get a lot more done face to face with them. So it's less of an email relationship and more of like, you know, hustling on 47th Street or 38th Street and actually visiting with people and really sitting down and like making sure the work's getting done.
And these are people who, you know, you feel like, you know them as family. I mean, it could be the eve of, you know, Thanksgiving vacation and everybody wants to go home and be with their family, and guys will stay late to make sure that your product for Neiman Marcus is ready, or, you know, Lizzie and I are showing up on a Friday morning with, you know, a box of donuts and a case of beer to thank them yeah. for what the weekend holds, or yeah. whatever it might be. I mean, we've definitely, like any small and growing business, have had those moments where, you know, one of our metalsmiths or maybe a seamstress or something does a project, and for whatever reason the project isn't right, and then all of a sudden it's Lizzie staying up till 3 a.m. before an order to shop up has to ship the next day, like, you know, remaking pieces.
Oh my goodness.
So there are definitely those moments where manufacturing is as hands-on as you could possibly envision. But then, of course, you sort of hit a stride, and now we've got our head, what we call it, seamstress, because our work really does require a lot of sewing, but it's also wire work and beading and things like that. But she was she works in-house for us, and she was a former seamstress for the Joffrey Ballet. So at this point, she'll see a sample from Lizzie. Lizzie will make the first sample of everything, but then she and Lizzie will really study it together, and then she'll suggest ways to make it better for production.
Well, and I feel like for a lot of our listeners, it might be confusing to hear that you have an in-house seamstress, but you're primarily selling jewelry. Is she working on your jewelry and your leather goods?
She's just working on jewelry. And okay. Seamstress is a misleading word. It's a word we use, but she's really an assembly person. There is a lot of sewing involved, because mm-hmm. we'll do mm-hmm. things with fringe and tassels mm-hmm. and feathers. But she's also
a lot
like
of mixed media.
Exactly. She's also stringing beads, doing wire work. So it's like this whole process of assembly. She's like a jewelry sample maker, basically.
We often say that the pieces are greater than the sum of their parts, excuse me, because normally, you know, an average necklace might pass through, even a simple one might pass through like easily 6 to 10 sets of hands before it reaches the store shelf.
So this leads me to my next question, which is like one of the things that Eric and I always say about your line and that we both respect so much is that you have a really identifiable aesthetic, and it evolves and every collection feels cohesive and is different. But you can always tell when it's yours.
It's very obviously Lizzie when you see a necklace on someone.
Well, we were just telling you guys last week, my husband, who's not like a keen observer of fashion, saw somebody at his office wearing one of your pieces and was like, hey, that's a Lizzie Fortunato necklace. And he was right because it's
and
so
proud.
And really proud of himself.
I mean, he bought you socks for Christmas to organize your sock drawer.
Hey, listen, he thinks about these things. So how do you guys think about your aesthetic?
We always say that we try not to be too trend driven, and it's interesting because people will ask me like, who's your it girl, who do you want to dress, and I'm so bad because I never know like the cool celebrity that I'm supposed to answer with, or the model off duty whose name I'm supposed to reply with. I was an art history minor, and I'm really influenced by fine art, and obviously travel plays a lot into our collections. So oftentimes we'll visit somewhere or see an art piece or even a building, some architecture or something that informs the collections, and then we really try and use that as a jumping off point to introduce different silhouettes and materials. So, for example, we were in Peru hiking the Inca Trail. We were bringing back all these Peruvian textiles, and suddenly these kind of like Aztec-y patterns that we were seeing around us started showing up in the embroideries that I was doing, in the bead patterns that I was doing. So we try and make artistic and architectural references with our pieces, you know, obviously that aren't too literal, but that have this kind of artistic nod.
And
I was going to say, we often use the term original dresser. So somebody who's maybe 20 or 60 or 80 and still can really sort of have this really cool confidence, whether she's a business person or an artist or an explorer or an innovator or maybe all of those things. Mm-hmm. And we really want someone who wants the piece because it tells a story. So, you know, it is mixed medium, and maybe when they're not wearing it, it's hanging on their wall as a little mini art object. But the aesthetic is much more, oh, we really don't like crafty and whimsical and all these words we've toyed with over the years, but there's definitely an arty side to what we're doing. Absolutely. We still like to think that there's a fashion side too.
Okay, something we have to get into, because it's another thing that Claire and I are obsessed with, is how you two work together. Your sisters, your business partners, you lived together for all of your lives for 30 years. Mm-hmm. You now live 5 blocks apart.
Which was like a huge...
Honestly,
it was like 5 blocks too far.
So how do you do that?
I think it works because our roles are so siloed. So we're twin sisters. Our roles are very different. I'm doing all of the creative direction, and Catherine's doing the operations and the finances, and honestly, we aren't interested in each other's roles.
Do you have opinions? Sometimes Lizzie is so ugly.
Yeah, and then Lizzie regrets even asking me what I thought of the necklace.
I think if I told Catherine how to balance the books, she would laugh. And honestly, when Catherine criticizes a piece, sometimes I take heed, but sometimes I'm just like, well, I don't trust your opinion here. I think we're both confident in our own roles, and we don't envy the other person's role. And we also really trust the other person. There's no person I want to do my taxes except Catherine.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So glamorous.
And she obviously trusts me. So we don't really step on each other's toes. I mean, we sit at opposite ends of the office. We email each other all day. We're not even really talking to each other because we're geographically separated in the office. And I think that's what makes it work. Because if we were totally doing everything together, we would be in each other's hair so much, and it would be a constant
bicker. Which has happened. I feel like we've learned, and I'm sure you guys went through a little bit of this. At this point, I would describe our relationship as very collaborative. Mm-hmm. And we actually welcome the moment, on the subway, in the commute, in the morning or the evening, having half an hour to really bounce ideas off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because in the office these days, as the business grows, we don't even get each other's ear for more than 5 minutes at a time. So if we really have something to talk about, it normally isn't even in the office that you get the full attention. But in the beginning, when you're creating the infrastructure and when you don't have the big team and when you're really doing everything and when you do want each other's sort of seal of approval on every decision that's made, that was when things were a lot harder. And I remember we were fighting. Lizzie and I are the kind of people who will literally have a screaming fight and then tell each other 2 minutes later how much we love each other. But
so how do you guys fight? What does that look like? But I mean, you're sisters, so you just go for it.
We're not aggressive. Yeah. There are never cat fights, but it's just a bunch of yelling and bickering. Yeah. And, you know, it's annoying for anybody else who's unfortunately in the office at that moment. But luckily, that really doesn't happen very much anymore. And I think these days, as Lizzie was saying, we really trust each other with the roles, but we are collaborative. If there's something I need her opinion on, I'll normally wait until like after work to ask her on the ride home, or like I'll shoot her an email and then I get like at least a few sentences that are thoughtful instead of just kind of screaming across the office at each other.
It's nice too, as you guys know, that as your team grows, you have more than just each other as sounding boards. So now when it's like we're talking about design, it's, I have an amazing assistant designer who I'm going to consult before I consult Catherine with a question. Or if we're talking about like what's going into a certain collection or what's being held for the next collection, like the production manager opines on that. So there's a lot of people who you can chat with, so it's not just the two of us going head to head about something.
So, okay, you brought up something that is sort of tangential, but I'm always really interested in. You guys work on seasons and you have collections, which a lot of jewelry designers don't. Did you always do it that way?
We did. We started out that way, and it's such a blessing and a curse because, I mean, every 3 months you're designing a new collection, and also we've really trained our customer to want something new every season. Okay. There are some jewelry designers who I love and admire who have fabulous classics collections, and while we've tried to do that a little bit, it hasn't so much worked for us because we have really trained people to expect something new. So we work on a fashion calendar, we show during fashion week, then we produce you know, during the season, and then deliver the collection, you know, like 8 to 12 weeks after we've shown it to the buyers. And we kind of liken it to the slow food movement. We call it slow production because everything is handmade and takes so long and passes through so many hands, as Catherine was saying. It is, we really need all of that time during that fashion week cycle to produce things and then get it to the store shelf.
So just like a fashion line might show their spring collection and their fall collection and their resort collection, that for all you listeners out there is what we deliver on as well.
So are you then, Lizzie, on a similar cycle where like you're spending 3 weeks designing and then 3 weeks figuring out production? And
yeah, I mean, I try and stay on that cycle. It's gotten so tricky just because it feels like we're always designing and producing. It used to be that I felt like I had some downtime, and now there's just never downtime because we're like always doing projects. And now that we've introduced Fortune Finds to the website, I'm like buying for the website as well. So, so it's hard to like stick to that schedule, but yes, we do have a schedule, and there are days where I'm like, this has to be a design day. We have to get like samples submitted to our metalsmith or designs submitted to our embroiderer in India for the bags today, because otherwise we're not going to have them when we shoot the lookbook right before Fashion Week.
And I remember that was like some of the great advice we got in the beginning, even though we did not heed it for years, was from, you know, our friend Aaron at Suno is a fantastic designer and probably far more organized than we were in the beginning. And I remember she kept emphasizing to you, you really need to make a calendar and you need to make it and stick to it, because you're just going to, you know, lose your mind otherwise.
What about for you, Catherine? Is it a similar, like certain times of the cycle are different for you, or are you just...
It ebbs and flows. It definitely ebbs and flows. So closer to Fashion Week, you know, I'm really focused on getting the buyers in the door and what we call market. So that sort of lines up with Fashion Week and goes a few days past it. And it's when all the buyers are in town. And you basically have this 10-day period to show your collection and sell it for the next season. So for me, that's a very sort of front-facing, sales-oriented time of the year. We joke that I wear heels every day that week because you can't sell in flats.
It's like you need the heels to bring you to attention.
Absolutely. So, you know, that's when it's, you know, you get to really reconnect with the buyers. You get to hear what's going on. You get to reach out to news stores. You know, if you're lucky, you're seeing some really fantastic buyers and editors. But then, of course, you know, you finish up Fashion Week, and if you're lucky, you go do it in Paris, and then you come back from that, and then all of a sudden, it's like, head to the ground, let's make this collection now.
Right.
And so I, from an operations perspective, will then work very closely with the production manager to take all the notes, take all the orders we just got, put them into production. And then, of course, after that, you've got the even less glamorous task of doing fulfillment, which we actually do from our office because everything's handmade there. So then it's boxing up, you know, 70 store orders. If it's a department store, they might have really strict barcoding rules. So then, you know, we own the company and are definitely still taping boxes some days. So
you guys work so hard.
I know.
Like so
I
mean, hard.
It's probably not the best example of how to start a business. No, but anyway.
Has how you think about work changed since the beginning of the business, or since your, you know, lives have evolved from your 20s to your 30s?
Definitely. I think in the beginning, it was all so new and exciting that like you couldn't. And also in the very beginning, before we had the office, I was doing it from home. So like I literally
there was zero separation.
Literally couldn't stop a project. Yeah. And it was just so novel and new. You were like, oh, we're till 4 a.m. And back then I could stay up all night back then and like not be tired. Like I was just really good at pulling all nighters, especially when I was designing. I would like have these nights where I would stay up all night and then be able to work the next day. It was crazy. And now I certainly cannot do that. But also the novelty of that obviously wears off. Yeah. You get to a point, I mean, we both have serious boyfriends. We now commute to the office. We don't live within walking distance of our office anymore. So you get to a point where you have to draw a line and say, like, it's midnight. I'm not staying here. This is ridiculous. So we have gotten a lot better at balancing. I think we say no to more. And I think we, like, kind of put our foot down about things. But
we also delegate a lot more.
Yeah.
Like, that whole thing about not making decisions together, we delegate to each other. Like, let's divide and conquer and not be coordinated every single second of the day. And let's delegate to our team, because two people can't necessarily handle the level of tasks there are to do in a given day.
Right.
What do you put your foot down about?
We get a lot of requests for special projects, collaborations, store visits, things
like that.
Even
special orders. I mean, I love working directly with customers, and I like doing things like custom bride's jewelry or something exclusive for a store. And typically, I try and accommodate it if it's like a special colorway or something that we can easily do. But it's definitely gotten to the point where if someone wants like one unit of a completely exclusive design, I just can't do it anymore. And I used to be able to. And every now and again, I will make one-of-a-kind pieces and I'll like Instagram it and sell it through that channel. Mm-hmm. But it's rare that I'm doing like 110% one-of-a-kind piece at this point, just from like someone who's blindly asking. I mean, if it's like a close friend or something, then I'll do it. But that kind of stuff I just don't have capacity for anymore, unfortunately, which it is fun to do, but it's hard to fit that in.
Yeah. But it's also exciting as you grow as a business to have your standard of what you say yes to get to increase. So having the bar raise and say, like, we'll do a store event, but, you know, we want to make sure it's 2 days, not one day. And we want to make sure that we bring this editor down with us or a blogger with us, or being able to just have the caliber and the quality of what you're doing be sort of higher and richer is so exciting, because at least you know that what you're spending your time doing is something that you're really getting behind. If Lizzie and I can't feel proud about it, then it's probably not fitting in our 24-hour day.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the thing that you really, like, want to do but just don't have the time or the resources right now, but are dying to do to expand your business?
That's a good question. We're doing a pop-up store right now, which has been a really awesome and rewarding experience. Because we have like such a diverse array of jewelry and leather goods, and then also these fortune finds, which are the lifestyle products that we've curated on our website. So because we have this wide range of products, it's nice to see them all in one space. Obviously, you can see that on our website, but seeing them in the flesh is really nice. And just kind of figuring out a way to do more pop-ups or create more some kind of experience where people can really understand the 360 vision of the brand, really building out fortune finds. I mean, one thing that I've been wanting to do is buy more for that, travel more so that I can source more products for that. Building out that kind of 360 vision is something that we continually talk about. With that said, I still love designing the jewelry and love our wholesale accounts, so I can't totally, you know, turn my back on that, and that takes a lot of my time. So I think it's like this kind of bigger brand picture that we want to focus on. Sadly, sometimes that gets like pushed to the back burner, to the, you know, the 2 a.m. hour, but I think that's kind of where our heads are at.
Totally. Having this little mini pop-up store has been such an amazing realization of the brand, like Lizzie was saying. So I think that we're realizing that in the ideal medium-term goal, eventually having brick and mortar to express that, it would be amazing. And our stores represent the product so well, but we would be able to do it in a way that showed the entire collection as opposed to a segment of it.
Okay, last question, because we've run long in the very best of ways. What's the most harebrained thing you guys have ever done for the business?
It's so funny. When we were just starting, we were convinced that we, like, as we were saying, had to go out to publicize the brand.
Because really, how would anybody know about it? Just two girls in a city of 8 million.
We used to tell my parents, we were like, it would be like 11, and we had all the energy in the world because we're 22 years old, and it would be 11 o'clock, and I would be talking to my mom, and I'm like, we're going to go do PR at the bar. And we used to go to the Beatrice Inn together, each with a stack of like 12 business cards, and say, like, we can't leave until we've each handed out all of our business cards.
What?
So we would like make, you know, and it's fun. Because
honestly,
it's like,
my mom like still hashtags PR at the bar. It's weird. We call her a moto mom.
But we really would like force ourselves to go out and talk to people. And this is like when we had more energy and we're like really excited to like just go chat with people at the Beatrice. But we would
I think
dance around and make ourselves hand out business cards.
That
That's as tacky as that sounds.
Oh my God, that is amazing. I love that.
That's awesome.
On that note, you have been listening to A Few Things with Claire and Erica. We are here every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
I feel like we need to bring these guys back for volume two. There's so much we didn't even ask.
This is tip of the iceberg.
Tip of the iceberg.
Well, we will come back to Roberta's any day.
We'll do a whole series about how you grow a small jewelry business.
Seriously.
Awesome.
Fantastic. Listen to us on heritageradionetwork.org. Download on iTunes or Stitcher. And
leave comments. Sign up for our newsletter. Buy all the things on our website.
Ofakind.com.
Bye.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.